Okay. Okay. That I think really is part one in many ways. Introductions, general concepts, general questions to think about. General functions for what transmediality might actually be. Of course, everything we've looked at so far is very contemporary. I said yesterday it's been understood as a product of a very contemporary media moment, so convergence culture, the rise of big multinational industries in the 1980s, the emergence of the internet and digital technologies that allow media to spread across different platforms, which is even more recent, so 1990s onwards. What I'm going to do now is take you back in time, okay? So I want you to think about how transmediality might not be a product just of convergence. It certainly is a product of convergence, but maybe it can also emerge in different ways, maybe different historical moments, different things happening in the past, that actually had the same result of allowing stories to be told across different platforms. So that's going to be the focus of this lecture. So I'm going to think about what it might be to consider transmedia storytelling historically. Initially, very, very briefly, just thinking about what I'm calling pre-historical history. So even further back in time, what might have happened thousands and thousands of years ago that might have some similarity to what we're talking about. But then most of the lecture will be early 20th century, and looking at how, at least I've discovered in my research, transmedia storytelling really became very prominent, very, very important, very commercially successful, but also quite socially and culturally and politically important throughout the 20th century, particularly in America, okay? So it's going to be looking at kind of the developments that happened that really enabled stories to be told across media in the past. So this should help you kind of think about, really broaden your understanding of transmediality. Now you've got a sense of what it is in the present moment. And actually, hopefully what you'll see is some of the things we've just been looking at, like promotion, brand, for example, actually are equally applicable to the past. And in some ways, they've emerged out of a historical context. You should hopefully be able to think about the practices of transmedia historically, so what it did in the past, and equally kind of analyse, how it was different as well, what forms it took, what type of stories did tend to be told, the strategies that were used, how audiences might have thought about it. So, prehistorical. So, obviously, I've said a lot about this being contemporary, being digital, being about big corporations, but a few scholars have actually pointed out, well, hasn't this been going on for thousands of years in some ways? The idea of a story crossing borders is surely not new at all. Roberta Pearson did a conference paper, and I think also wrote about this, talking about the idea of Jesus Christ as a narrative, as a story, as something that manifests culturally around the world. Well, isn't that transmedia? Isn't that about creating an idea of a story that is then extended across platforms? If we think about the idea of Jesus, it doesn't exist on one platform. It exists across a whole range of platforms. Obviously in print, the Bible, for example, but if you think about churches and stained glass windows, they all offer a sort of little mini story of their own every time you look in a different direction in a church that tells you something else. And obviously you can learn about various aspects of this particular idea in different places. Well, isn't that transmedia storytelling? Derek Johnson moves things forward a little bit, and he talks about ancient Greece and how actually certain mythological stories were actually kind of created across things like pottery and, you know, in caves and various kind of written forms that actually told stories in the past. They didn't have films, they didn't have TV, they didn't have mass media, But they had platforms, they had tools, and all of these tools were quite useful to creating particular narratives about whatever might have been important at that particular time. Isn't that transmedia storytelling? So there's a sense it's always been there. We've just not really talked about it until recently. But what I'm kind of more interested in, what I'm going to focus on, is the industry behind this. I think all of this is really interesting, but it's also very difficult to actually understand it on any precise level. It seems quite a vague idea to say, well, maybe it was the story of Jesus, or maybe it was ancient Greece. How did it actually emerge as an industry? What actually happened? What were the big developments? What did industries actually do that enabled stories to be told across platforms? And as I hinted, all of these things we've been talking about, we can actually trace them historically. So I suggested it's a form of promotion. As you'll see in a moment, I'm going to suggest it emerged out of advertising historically. I've suggested it's a form of branding. I'm going to talk about how it emerged out of branding 100 years ago. And so on and so forth. The idea of consumerism, for example, is a historical moment that was incredibly important. So we can really use all of this contemporary knowledge to actually explain historically where it came from. And specifically, what I'm going to do is offer three moments, if you like, three historical moments that I think were really, really important. 1900, as I'm going to talk about, I think is vitally important to understanding how transmedia storytelling emerged as an industry, okay? And particularly, it's to do with industrialization, and I'll explain why in a moment. Because of certain things that happened when industrialization happened, things like mass production and the rise of advertising as an industry. And I think, actually, if you look, say, between 1900 and 1920, it was those two things, industrialization and advertising, that were really important to enabling stories to be told across platforms. But like all things, it changes, you know. So the digital media wasn't always there. That seems important now through Facebook and web series and so on. But that wasn't always there. So what was in the place of that in the past? I think if you look kind of 1920s, 1930s, something else was more important. So this is when consumer culture started to emerge. And I'm going to talk about why that was so important. And particularly developments in these kind of things. We've already looked at merchandising, but this emerged historically. And licensing emerged at this time. I'll explain why that's important. And as you move even forward in time, so 1940s, so this is, of course, World War II era, I'll kind of point to how things that you might think have nothing to do with transmedia storytelling, propaganda, for example, actually had a hell of a lot to do with transmedia storytelling. So, I said industrialization was important. Industry, of course, did emerge before 1900, but it was, at least in America, it was 1900 when industrialization officially happened. So the rise of mass industries, the rise of mass production on a huge scale, and particularly a certain style of production. So what became known as Fordism, okay? So this was a kind of a practice of production that emerged specifically around cars, Henry Ford, of course, Ford car. Where it was, you know, the idea that now just seems common knowledge to us all, that if we're going to produce something on a mass scale and we want all of the products to be the same, why spend all of our energies on one product and then make another product and then make another? Why don't we just have a conveyor belt and we have different people at different stages of that conveyor belt, and one person focuses on the wheels and someone else focuses on the exterior and someone else focuses on the interior, and then you kind of pass it along and each person does the same thing over and over again. That will be cheaper, it will be quicker, and it will mean the product gets made in exactly the same way over and over and over again. It now just seems common knowledge. So this was kind of what happened at the time. And of course, if we think about this in a really simple sense, you can't have transmedia storytelling without that. Transmedia is dependent on multiple products being produced. You can't just have a film, otherwise it's not transmedia. You need a game, and you need a comic book, and you need a website, and so on and so forth. So you need mass production. You need to be able to produce all of these things on a mass scale that can then be targeted toward mass audiences in a way that's going to encourage that mass audience to move across different platforms. And you need them all to be exactly the same with slight differences, okay? And of course, this is what happened at the time. We had Fordism and mass production, but then something very slightly changed. They changed the pattern slightly. So instead of making all cars exactly the same, they had the idea, what if they were all exactly the same, but slightly different in some way? That was important because it meant that people would buy another car. They thought, well, if we're going to make all cars the same, once you've bought a car, you're not going to buy another one. So we need to make them slightly different each time, a different model, for example, a different version, so that people will then be tempted to buy the next version, buy another model. That's transmedia, isn't it? All the Matrix things are the Matrix. They all tell the same type of story, the same characters, they're all essentially the same product, but each one has a very slight difference. Slightly different story with a slightly different emphasis on a character, so that when it comes to you consuming that, it's the same as the other one, but you want to consume it because it's slightly different. So it's the same kind of mentality that's really important. Mass producing things on a mass scale with slight differentiation. So this is no surprise when stories and authors particularly, so novelists, began to be able to mass produce their stories. So novels suddenly became mass produced. But it also meant that it started to spread. It made more and more and more and more of something. So a nice example would be The Wizard of Oz. So The Wizard of Oz was a novel written by L. Frank Baum in 1900. It became mass-produced as a product. And because of this culture of industrialization, this culture of mass production, it grew, and they kept making more and more and more and more and more of it, with slight variations each time. So we have the book that then becomes a sequel, that again gets another sequel and another sequel and another sequel. We then get newspapers that are very similar to the Dark Knight Rises examples yesterday. So taken from the world of the film, in this case called the Osmopolitan, where you can read about fake stories existing in the land, the magical land of Oz. It becomes a theatre play, which becomes another theatre play. Silent cinema, of course, emerges around this particular time, 1900. So we start to get Wizard of Oz films and sequels to the Wizard of Oz films. Mass production, of course, is in line with mass communication and newspapers. It's no coincidence around that time we get the first comic strips that have ever emerged. So we then get Wizard of Oz comic books, okay? And actually, what's important about all of this stuff is that a lot of it is advertising, okay? Much like what we've been talking about. So comic strips at this time, of course, this is 100 years ago, right? They haven't yet become comic books. You know, going and buying a comic book, that hasn't happened yet. At this point, they exist purely in a newspaper. And the reason why they existed in a newspaper is because they were seen as so fun and so enjoyable that it was a way to encourage people to buy a newspaper. So if you've got a row of newspapers and you think, well, which one am I going to buy? If you've got a really fun Wizard of Oz comic strip inside, the idea was you'd be more tempted to buy that particular one. So it's a form of advertising, okay? This is a form of advertising. That there at the top is a map that was produced for a particular play that was handed out to people in the street as a way to advertise the Wizard of Oz play. And of course, that's also a storytelling in a way, isn't it? It's telling you about the story world. It's telling you where the different countries are existing in relation to one another. You know that the Emerald City is now in the centre of the country, for example. And certain practices started to be quite important. And this seems a really strange example, but it will make sense in a second. Colour, okay? So at this point, this is when it's not just about mass production and mass publishing. This is when colour publishing, colour printing, started to become much more common, simply because it's mass production, so they could do it on a cheaper scale than they could previously. So everything was now printed in colour, okay? And what this meant was that advertisers got hold of this colour scheme, or colour coding scheme, if you like, as a way to advertise products and to encourage people to buy more things and to move across different platforms. So you would have things like cigarette cartons, for example. So how do they get you to keep buying more of that particular brand? Well, they put these cards in that might have been, say, pictures of animals, or they might have been pictures of flags, or they had pictures of baseball players and pictures of countryside and so on and so forth. And more often than not, they were a set. So each card would be like one in a set. There might be 10 in total, and you would have to collect all of these particular cards. Sometimes it was even like a jigsaw puzzle, in the sense that one card would be the corner of a picture. So you'd have to keep buying more cigarettes to get more cards, to put all the pieces together to create a picture. And they were always linked, more often than not, by colour schemes. You would know that they connected to one another, these kind of jigsaw-style pictures, in terms of the colour. So you know that, you know, this is the greenery of the trees, for example, or this is the blue of the sea. So you knew how they all kind of connected together. So by using colour, it was a way to encourage people to buy more products. Okay, it was a way to advertise more products in quite a creative way. And this then starts to merge into storytelling. Okay, it starts to influence how authors and storytellers actually told stories. So L. Frank Baum was an advertiser, which is quite important. Before he became a novelist, he was an advertiser. So he was very aware of these kind of practices. So when he wrote the first Wizard of Oz novel, he was very careful to use colour illustrations and coloured the pages in a way that actually mirrored this kind of an idea. So, you know, when you're reading chapter one, which is brown, it's a way to tell you that Dorothy, the lead character, is in Kansas. So it's telling you where she is. This is from a later part in the book. It changes to green to tell you that she's now entered Oz. She's in a different place. But then as she moves through the different countries, the colours change again, and they mirror that map at the top. Okay, so when she's in the Gillikin country, the pages are green. When it's the Quadlings, it's red. When she's in the Emerald City, it's, of course, emerald green. So it's a way of telling you where she is in the story. Okay, but it's a way of using colours as a way to tell the story in a visual way. And so what this meant is that this then extended into a sort of transmedia strategy through things like the map that I mentioned. So when things like the map were given out in the street, or when other form of colour-coded products were given out in the street, you knew as an audience where all of this connected together. You knew now, okay, well, that green place that famously we didn't know was the north of Oz. We now know it's the north of Oz because we've been given this map. We knew that the Emerald City was green, but we didn't really know that it was in the centre of the story world. Now we know it's in the centre of the story world. So giving this kind of print, colour-coded information actually expands your understanding of the story. It tells you something about the world of Oz, its world building, in a way that you didn't actually know from watching the book. And the thing that's underpinning this is colour coding. And the concept of colour coding emerged from the rise of advertising, which emerged from the emergence of mass production and industrialisation. So maps actually became a transmedia tool. So again, here is the kind of the Lord of the Rings version. Michael Saylor is a really interesting scholar, talks about how different authors would use maps at this particular time to tell audiences more about particular stories. So these were like the social media tools of the day, in a sense, giving you something quite fun, something that seems quite trivial, but it's actually quite interesting and engaging and creative and tells you something more about the story world in question. So as I mentioned, mass production, this meant things like newspapers. So we would get all of these really sort of interesting newspapers. You would read, is it on there? Not sure. To give you one example, they did an interview with the Scarecrow, so a character from Oz, for example. And this was all written by L. Frank Baum, so the author of the original books. And he would do sort of like funny fake interviews with the different characters, where you could read about what the Scarecrow was actually up to. You could learn more about him as a character. Of course, when you see him in The Wizard of Oz, it's a very brief period of time. You don't really get to know him that well. So if you read this particular newspaper, and this was advertising, this was handed out to people in the street, you can then do character building. You can learn more about this particular character. And as I mentioned, things like comic strips started to emerge as well, which didn't tell the same story as the book. It told additional stories. So here, you know, is an example of Dorothy's Christmas tree, for example. So it's the same characters. You've got Dorothy, you've got the Scarecrow, you've got the Wizard, but it's extending those stories. It's telling you something else that wasn't in the book, but connects in a clearly transmedial storytelling fashion. And this is not, if anything, common of the era. I don't want you to think that The Wizard of Oz was somehow entirely unique and nothing else was going on. That was very representative of what was going on. So this is kind of probably the most famous comic strip character of the era, kind of 1902, 1903, called Buster Brown. He was a character that started in comic strip form, and you would read his adventures in newspapers. And it started to spread through things like mass production. You would get Buster Brown shops, for example, where you could buy Buster Brown merchandise. The character started to appear in other adverts. So, you know, in something that has nothing to do with it, like selling shoes, the character would start to cross over, crossing platforms, crossing different media, seeing him appearing in different way. We got also, similarly with Oz, Buster Brown theatre shows, which also told different stories, maybe appealing to a different audience. So this is very kind of, you know, specific of the culture. Mass production, making more and more products, enabling these characters to spread across borders. But the rise of advertising being really important in terms of pointing audiences across different platforms. So one example from the comic strips, a very sort of fun example. There were also spin-off books that I didn't mention based around secondary characters like the Scarecrow and the Tin Woodman, where you follow those adventures. But things like comic books, you could follow the stories that happened in between the books. So there was The Wizard of Oz, the story I'm sure you're all familiar with. Dorothy leaves Kansas, she goes to Oz, she has her adventure with the Scarecrow and the Tin Woodman and the Wizard, then she goes back home again. There was a sequel that picks up a few years later that actually didn't have Dorothy in it at all. She wasn't the character. So in the comic, they thought, well, okay, audiences really liked Dorothy. She was the lead character in the book. She was the lead character in the theatre play. Audiences are going to want to know more about that character. So let's tell that story in the comic strip. So one of the stories that happened was at the end of The Wizard of Oz, we learned that the Scarecrow and the Tin Man, who of course become friends with Dorothy in that story, they soon miss her. They want to see her again. They're really sad that she goes back to Kansas and they never see her ever again. So they develop a little mission, effectively, where they actually travel to Kansas to be reunited with Dorothy again. So it's like a sequel in many ways, but it's clearly telling you a new story that connects to the first one. It's building the characters, it's developing those characters, and it's also building the story world around it. There was another slightly more trivial comic strip story where we found out what happened to the Kansas farm after Dorothy left it. So of course we see it get destroyed by this enormous cyclone at the beginning of the film or the story. We find out what happened as a result of that. So what did Uncle Henry, Dorothy's uncle, how did he rebuild the farm? So we learn that he goes and gets another mortgage to rebuild his house, for example. This is character building, this is world building, this is telling another story on a different platform. So it's transmedia storytelling. This was an interview I did with someone called Peter Hampf. There is such a thing, believe it or not, as a Wizard of Oz club. There's an international Wizard of Oz club where people celebrate everything about the Wizard of Oz. And this guy was the chair of this particular club, at least for a number of years. And I was asking him kind of about this and trying to understand it. And he very much agreed. Well, he says, you know, clearly these comics expand our understanding of what these characters are like. But a nice little insight is that according from the view of L. Frank Baum, who was the author of the books, but also wrote the comics and wrote the plays and was really the creator of the whole thing, didn't think about it as storytelling. He thought about it purely as advertising. He approached newspapers and said, let's create a comic strip because it will promote the new book. It will promote the sequel. For him, it was all about the novel. For reasons you can probably understand, it's historical. The novel was seen as, you know, really important art form at that particular time. So he didn't really care about the comics. They were just a way of advertising. But he did it through storytelling. And this, of course, echoes, you know, the Doctor Who example, making a trailer for a TV show. But rather than just making a poster or a trailer, tell a story. Tell the audience something new as a way to promote a book. But I think it's quite interesting that at that point, unlike today, he didn't think about it as storytelling, but nowadays it clearly is. This then spreads even further, okay? So it's not just books and comic strips and newspapers and maps, it's also film. So I mentioned this is when cinema began to emerge, early 20th century. Wizard of Oz has now spread across so many platforms, become so popular, reached so many audiences, it's not a surprise that it suddenly became a film, of course, a silent film in 1910. And these same types of ideas actually started to happen in cinemas. So when the cinema, when the film was actually screened to audiences, they would get these kind of things handed out to them in the lobby. They would get like colouring books, and they would get pamphlets, and they would get leaflets. that actually offered you something more about the story. They had little snippets of plot information, little quotes from characters, little interviews with the various characters that connected to the story of the film but told you something more about those characters. So you could go into the film, you were about to watch it, and then you could look down and you can read, and you had this accompanying piece of media that expanded your understanding of what was on the screen. This was, of course, mass production. It can't happen without mass production. Colour, industrialisation, the culture of advertising, all of this is kind of going on in the background. But, really sort of interesting point here. Everything I've mentioned so far suggests that transmedia exists because it makes money. Industries like it because it makes money. You can extend a story across, you can encourage the audience to move across platforms, you can keep people aware of that particular story, keep them buying the game, keep them buying the film, extend that story over and over again. Historically, it wasn't quite that simple. And actually, The Wizard of Oz, despite being a really prominent example, this wasn't a small thing. This was probably what, you know, the most famous children's story of the era, that, as you've seen, was multiple novels and had a huge audience and was films, and those films made sequels, and there was comic strips and maps. Actually, it lost money. So not only did it not make money, in terms of for L. Frank Baum, the author, it lost so much money that the poor guy was bankrupt as a result of doing it, okay? And the reason was transmedia storytelling made him bankrupt. So the novels made money, okay? Novels were seen as really, really important at this particular time. They were prestigious, they were respected, they were seen as quite kind of middle class or upper class. They were quite expensive to buy as well. All of those things made money. But Baum was so interested in this idea of transmedia, whether it was for advertising purposes or something else, he was so interested in making these comic strips and making these maps and making these leaflets that were handed out to people in the street or handed out to people as they were entering the cinema. And what I kind of realised through digging into this was, because there wasn't an industry behind this was just him doing this, he paid for most of it himself. So he actually paid to, say, have all of those colour illustrations in his books, which cost him money. He had to pay for those maps of Oz to be handed out to people in the street. He had to pay for those accompanying booklets that were handed to people in the cinema. So even though the books made money, and of course the films probably would have made money, because there wasn't this transmedia or marketing industry behind how to actually do this, he paid for all of this himself. And it cost him so much money to do that, that even the costs he made from things like the books didn't balance out, and he lost all of his money. So one of the most famous authors of the early 20th century was bankrupt by 1916 because he tried to extend all of these stories across platforms. So the point is that it could happen. Industrialization enabled it to happen. Advertising was incredibly important in generating this culture where audiences move across different platforms. But it wasn't quite yet a viable practice. It wasn't quite yet an industry that enabled authors such as Baum to actually make money out of doing this. If anything, it was a money loser rather than a money maker. And the last thing before a quick break is this kind of quote from David Kushner, who's an academic. I'm putting this up purely as a way to contradict, okay? So he's talking about the differences between transmedia storytelling now, how we've understood it now, and everything else that came before. And he draws this very clear line that says, well, promotion has got nothing to do with the transmedia storytelling of the digital era. I'm pointing that up purely to say, A, as we've seen in the lecture this morning, that's not really true. And also in a historical context, it's really important to understand that advertising, in some sense, enabled the culture of telling stories across platforms, enabling the whole idea of pushing people across different platforms to buy more products, to buy more versions of a particular story. So again, blurring these two ideas of promotion and storytelling together. Was the break, was it 5:02 or 5 past? Was it 5 past? That's fine. Okay, so that was sort of 1900, early sort of 20th century. I said that things kind of moved on and other things became kind of more important. The other thing that's, of course, going on, starting to happen at this point, that really became quite prominent around 1918, 1920, was the idea of consumer culture. We take this for granted nowadays. It's just there, the idea of consumerism. But, of course, it wasn't always, okay? So this is really when consumerism, the whole idea of consumerism, so industries really starting to promote the idea that we should buy more and more things. The whole sort of philosophy behind consumer culture, and I'm making this really, really dumbing this down, but most simply, I think the whole idea of consumer culture is, it's the message, right? If we buy more products, our life will be richer. That's the mentality behind consumer culture. That's kind of what industry sort of wants us to think. If you buy more, your life will be better. Okay, if you buy more brands, your life will be better. If you buy more and more products, if you keep buying more and more things, somehow your life will be richer. Somehow it will be more interesting. Somehow you'll have more to do in your life. If you buy another car, you will be happier. It's that idea. Okay, that idea, of course, I think very much underpins the idea of transmedia storytelling as Jenkins defined it. You know, it's the idea, if you move across platforms, if you buy more products, if you buy more versions of the story, Jenkins says you will have a more enjoyable experience. It makes a fuller experience, as he said, because you learn more about the characters, you engage more with the storytelling. It's the same sort of idea. If you go and buy the game, you will have a richer experience. You are consuming it, and because of that, you will have a richer experience. If you then go and watch the next film, you will learn something more about the characters. So you will have a richer experience. So you are costing yourself money, you are being a consumer, but in return, you somehow get a richer or happier experience. So in other words, this, in a very general sense, the whole idea of consumerism is what's underpinning the whole idea of transmediality. It is consumerism. It has to be seen as a form of consumerism. So this starts to emerge, sort of 1920s, really starts to become prominent in the US, kind of 1920s. And it starts to influence authors, okay, in terms of their thinking. Make people buy more of my story. Don't just tell one story. Let's make more of it, because this is the era of consumerism. This is the philosophy of consumerism. So this is a really nice quote by Edgar Rice Burroughs. So Burroughs is the author of Tarzan, most famously. And this is him explaining his whole philosophy of storytelling and why he tells stories. My youngest boy collects empty matchboxes. The fact that they are all of the same kind makes no difference to him, but in that he shows the true spirit of the collector and of the reader. The really great purpose of fiction, as I see it, is like stepping stones of entertainment. The reading of fiction motivates you to flow to the next stepping stone, just like a collector of matchboxes, and lo, a new world will be open to him. So in one sense, he's talking about just general storytelling. You read the beginning of a story, you then want to find out what happens next. So you want to get to the middle, and then you want to get to the end. But of course, when you get to the end, you also continue want to know what happens next. It's the nature of storytelling. It doesn't really end. And he's aligning this to the whole idea of consumerism and buying products. So in that sense, if storytelling is about wanting to learn more and wanting to know more and continue following the stories and continue to buy more and more products, is it really any different to someone who collects a matchbox, buying another product over and over and over again? All the products are the same. All the Tarzan stories are kind of the same. All the Wizard of Oz stories are kind of the same. But it doesn't matter, because it's about collecting and it's about wanting to find out what happens next. Okay? So this is kind of culturally what's quite important. The whole idea of wanting to keep consuming the same things over and over, keep following the story over and over. Around this particular time, industrially, things started to move forward. So what I just mentioned there about Baum not really being able to make money, things started to change around sort of early, mid-20th century, okay? Particularly kind of what happened is shops, sources, sites of consumerism, of course, started to connect or converge, you might say, with films, okay? So rather than just the film industry being over there and a shop that sells soap being over there, why don't they connect together in some way? Why don't they cross-promote one another? If we do that, we will encourage this mentality of stepping stones, right? Consume this, buy this product, then point the audience over to a film. stepping stones of entertainment. Okay, so nice little example here. There's a film called Husbands Are Good for Something. This was a film in a sense, but it was effectively a form of advertising. It was a film made by made by a company, and they were trying to advertise their merchandise, trying to advertise their product. So they made a film as a way to do that, with the thinking being exactly the same. If you make the film, you're then going to encourage people to go to the merchandise, encourage you to consume over and over again. And this was something I took from a newspaper that seems quite representative of kind of how people were thinking, how industry were thinking at this particular time. A good film is known by the merchandise itself, not by the reviews, not by how many people went to see it, not whether people think it's good or not, whether it's artistic or creative, but whether it sells other things. To me, that is exactly the idea of what we've been talking about. The Matrix film is trying to sell you a game, which is trying to sell you a comic book. And that's how we're understanding it. That's how we're defining it as a form of success. And that mentality was always there, 1920s. Something else which, of course, kind of underpins this, and this was very specifically 1918. So just after L. Frank Baum had gone bankrupt, licensing comes into play. And what licensing allows is a legal contract, if you like, that enables products or films or media to be extended onto something else and to be made into another form. Clearly transmedia, okay? This is sort of the definition. So it's when one person, say like a creator or an author, for example, gives rights to somebody else to manufacture it on another platform, okay? And this, it's no surprise that this emerges early 20th century. This whole idea of consumerism, pushing people across different platforms, keeping people engaged, keeping them consuming. Licensing was the kind of legal response to that. It was a way to make this official, make this a practice that enabled people to make money in a way that someone like L. Frank Baum actually hadn't been able to do. So licensing effectively explains this. So Tarzan becomes transmedia, okay? Edgar Rice Burroughs was incredibly clever in how he did this. He was really one of the first authors to really make use of licensing to a really strong degree. So he licensed it all over the place. He licensed it to so many different media platforms in a way that it looks just like the Wizard of Oz example, but it enabled him to make money because there was a legal contract in place. He didn't have to pay for this himself. Other people paid for it. Other people took the risk, and he gained royalties as a result because he owned Tarzan. So it became various films, various motion pictures, endless. I think if you're going to look it up, it's into the hundreds how many Tarzan films have been made. Like with Oz, it became comic strips, multiple comic strips that told additional stories that weren't in the novels, for example. It became a very, very successful radio play, which Burroughs actually co-wrote. So a number of the scripts were actually written by him. And these also told different adventures to what we saw in the novels. Originally, and we'll do this after the break, it started in pulp magazines. So before it was even a novel, it was a pulp story. So pulp novels were kind of very, very cheap, quite unrespectable forms of media that told quite trashy stories that were very kind of cheap to produce. It became lots and lots of merchandise, lots and lots of comic books, and so on and so forth. We have a quick break now and then kind of move on to explaining all of this. All right?